Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
The weather's taking a little turn for the cooler.
It has gotten cooler, that's for sure.
The leaves are starting to fall.
Well, but they're still green. There's more green ones than anything else. They're not turning. We don't see the colors.
Pumpkin spice is everywhere.
Yeah, pumpkin spice is everywhere.
Lots of ghost stories.
Every time I come home, Mary's got another candle lit in another room. Started out with one, and there was two. Now, last night when I went to bed, I had to blow out six candles before I went to bed.
Are they all pumpkin flavored?
Yeah, they're all some kind of pumpkin spice or something spice or, you know, scarecrow spice or...
Scarecrow spice?
Something like that.
It's one of the Spice Girls.
Yeah, they're everywhere, and I'm going around blowing them out. And I said, Mary, there's another damn candle. She said, I know, don't they smell good? Don't blow them out, let them burn all night. And I said, no, I don't want to burn the house down.
You know those wax thingies that you can heat up and that you put the different scented waxes in there?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I used to love those things. And about maybe this time last year, they started giving me a headache when I smell them now.
Really?
Yeah.
Must be an allergy of some type to it.
I don't know. I was reading something up on it, like some sort of like scent-induced migraine or something like that. And it's, I guess maybe I'm very, very...
Sensitive
or sensitive.
I think you're sensitive.
I am sensitive.
You're sensitive.
I do have a sensitive side.
He may have an aggressive beard, but he's sensitive on the inside.
That's true. I am sensitive on the inside.
Well, the one thing I don't like about those wax heated things is, have you ever spilled one?
Oh, it makes a mess.
Oh, it's terrible to try to clean that stuff up. It's everywhere.
Yeah, and it smells.
And when you have grandkids running around the house, they're bound to get spilled.
No doubt. Well, we're actually not doing a podcast about like Martha Stewart on some sort of home tips for candles and scents around your house.
No, because we make very little sense.
And we're not the kind of dudes to talk about that, probably. But we are going to talk about one of our favorite subjects, kind
of. October booings.
October booings.
And brewings.
And brewings.
Booze and brews.
So the idea for this episode is based off of a beer.
It's based off of a beer. Oh, yeah, that's true. But yep. Before you get into that, there's a story that I came across that I just found unbelievable.
Okay.
It has to do with the, you know, during this time of the season, people set up these haunted houses to attract people to come to and everything.
Yep.
And this one took place in Akron, Ohio. And so, I don't know, probably people in Ohio have heard about this. I don't know if the rest of the country would, although it just shows a complete lack of awareness, I believe.
Okay.
Now, this place books itself as being edgy, and you know, it's like a real graphic experience, and they have signs up that warn you that that people may lay hands on you and this and everything. Mm-hmm. So they're really trying to scare you, you know.
Yeah.
However, this took it a little bit too far. It says an Ohio man was forced to participate in a mock rape at a haunted house in Akron, his girlfriend claims.
What?
Sarah Lelonick and her boyfriend Ryan Carr were at one of six haunted houses comprising Fright Fest. And although there are signs warning things could get physical, the couple said it went too far. Lelonick said what happened to her boyfriend was inappropriate. I saw him push my boyfriend down and then push his shoulders back onto the bed, and I said, "That's my boyfriend, please stop." And he said, "Well, he's not your boyfriend anymore. I'm going to rape him." And then he proceeded to act like he was raping him. So he said that at another one of the haunted houses, there was a man telling them that they had to lick his nipples to get out. So I think that, you know, common sense would say if you're going to run something, mock rape is never a good idea. It's never acceptable. So... you know, now the guy that owned it, the managing partner, a guy named Jeremy Cottle, he said, he said he's shocked and appalled at these incidents and has suspended several employees in the wake of allegations. Even a mock rape scene has no place as part of any entertainment. Duh, you think so, Jeremy? That takes some real brilliance to discover that. So they said that they will add additional security to the haunted houses. They don't need additional security. They need employee screening or something.
Yeah.
That's what they need.
No kidding.
And they said they've also announced they will now donate part of their proceeds from the two upcoming weekends to the Rape Crisis Center of Median and Summit Counties.
Well, that's good.
Well, yeah, that's good. But it says some of their profits, you know, slip them a couple bucks or something.
Wow.
You know, but, you know, first of all, I don't think these people would take it on themselves to say, hey, I know it's a good idea. Let's scare people by mock raping them. I think somewhere they were given the idea, and this guy's like, oh, no, we would never condone that. They're going to be disciplined. You believe me, you, those rascals.
Well, I mean, I'd be curious if, like, other people experience the same thing or if this is a one-time event.
I don't know.
That's whatever it is. I don't know.
Well, maybe that was the first time it happened, and then after everything that hit the fan, maybe they said, oh, maybe that wasn't a good idea.
Yeah.
I thought it was only frowned upon.
Let's storyboard this again. Well, so this episode, as I said, had a basis in the Halloween theme and also in a kind of one of our favorite subjects is beer.
Beer.
Now, there is a brewery in West Virginia called Greenbrier Valley Brewing, and it's in Lewisburg, West Virginia. Actually, I think it's in Maxwelltown, but that's basically Lewisburg. And they have a beer. They have several good beers.
I've tasted several of their offerings and have enjoyed every one.
Yeah, I've actually been there, too. They have a very nice tap room there at their local place. It's really cool.
I've seen it. It was in a magazine, a West Virginia magazine. I looked. They had a big article on it, and it looked really nice.
The one they have, that a lot of people have had, is called Devil Ants, which is an IPA.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's one of the better IPAs I've actually ever had.
Sydney likes that one.
Yeah, and it's named for a relative of ours from the Hatfield side of the family, the Hatfield-McCoy thing.
Yep.
And it's really good. It's brewed here in West Virginia. But the beer that kind of gave us inspiration for this episode is called Zona's Revenge.
Zona's Revenge.
Now
it's made with water from Mexico.
It used to be called, the same beer, the same recipe was called Lily Dipper.
Yeah.
It was a seasonal thing, but then they changed the name to Zona's Revenge.
Mm-hmm. Now, I had it when it was Lily Dipper.
As an aside, do you know what Lily Dipper, what that means or what it is?
No, I do not.
Well, I know from my whitewater rafting experience that a Lily Dipper is a person who does not place their entire paddle in the water and not paddling efficiently. They're paddling very weakly. They're just putting just the tip in. And they're just a Lily
Dipper. That's what she said.
They're just a Lily Dipper. So you don't want to be a Lily Dipper. You want to get your full paddle in there. So.
That's what she said.
But anyway.
This is too easy.
I don't know why they called it Lily Dipper to begin with or why they changed the name. But
I don't either, but I had it when it was Lily Dipper. I didn't know that's what I was drinking.
Yeah.
But I mean, yes, I had it when it was really good.
It was. And now they call it Zona's Revenge. And I didn't know why it was called Zona's Revenge. But if you actually look at the label, it's got a ghost on the label. And she's like pointing in the direction. And,
that's because it's spirits inside.
That's right. It's pretty delicious. It actually tastes a lot like a Hoo Garden, if you know what that is.
Yeah.
It's
I always thought
good.
It was a Hoo Garden.
Well, you know, you could say it either way.
Hoo Garden, Hoo Garden.
But Zona's Revenge.
Drink it at your hoedown.
Zona's Revenge is based off of the story from called the Greenbrier Ghost.
The Greenbrier Ghost.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. It's supposedly the only case in which the word of a ghost helps solve a crime and convict a murderer.
In U.S. history.
Yeah, in U.S. history.
That's right.
So,
just around here, folks. We're talking nationwide.
That's right.
Old Zona, she's well known.
Well, kind of well known. Now, her name was Elva Zona Hester, and she was born in Greenbrier County, West Virginia, sometime around 1873. They say sometime because things are a little fuzzy back then. They don't know the exact.
They didn't have real good record keeping back in them there days.
Yeah, especially in Greenbrier County.
Courthouses burnt down a lot, too.
They did. Greenbrier County is pretty sparse these days to begin with.
Yeah.
So back then, I imagine there wasn't
a lot
of people.
It was even sparser.
It's even sparser.
Sparser than the hairs on Kojak's head.
So not much is known about her, her early life or anything like that. But she gave birth to a child in 1895. And then a year later, in 1896, she met a man named Erasmus, which is a great name, by the way.
Erasmus.
Erasmus. But he also went by Edward, and his full name was Erasmus Stribling Trout Shoe.
right there, you know you're in trouble. I mean, that doesn't mix with Elva Zona Hester already. That's a hell of a name.
And he was a drifter who had moved to Greenbrier County to work as a blacksmith and wanted to start a new life for himself. So here you have a blacksmith drifter moving to Greenbrier County, West Virginia in 1896.
Yeah, that's a recipe for disaster.
That's right. Back then, it was basically a lot of horses and whatnot there. So as a blacksmith, you had a lot of jobs shoeing horses and things like that. So it was a job that was in demand.
Sure. Probably a lot of mules, too, pulling carts in and out of the mines and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's how they used to do it.
Yeah.
So Zona met Shoe.
Shoe.
We'll call him Shoe.
Hey, Shoe.
Shortly after he came to town. And they struck up a relationship, and they were mutually attracted to each other. And they were married pretty soon after they met. Now, there was one person that really did not approve so much of this marriage. Can you hear who that was?
Was it Zona's daddy?
Close. It was Zona's mother.
Okay.
Mary Jane Robinson Heaster, or Hester. She actually disliked him from the very beginning and felt like he was always hiding something. He was always up to no good.
He was, I'm sure. You can tell by all those names, their aliases.
So they lived together as husband and wife for a couple months. And then on January 23rd, 1897, Zona's body was discovered inside of their house by a young boy that Shu had sent to the house on what some called a contrived errand. Evidently, Shu had asked the boy to run to the house from the blacksmith shop and see if there was anything that Zona needed from the store. And when the boy, his name was Andy Jones, he found Zona lying on the floor at the bottom of the stairs.
The only one in this story with a regular name, Andy Jones.
Andy Jones. So Andy Jones found her lying at the foot of the stairs with her feet together, one hand on her abdomen and the other lying next to her, and her head was turned slightly to one side. Her eyes were wide open and staring. And so basically, he could tell that she was deceased. So he ran home to tell his mother about it, and then the local doctor and coroner, a Dr. George W. Knapp, came to the house, but it took him about an hour to get there.
Well, he was taking a nap.
Probably. Sleeping off that bourbon.
Probably.
I can just picture it. I already have it in my mind. Now, by the time the coroner got there, Shu had already gone back to his house, and he had carried his wife's body upstairs and had laid her out in the bed. And he dressed the corpse himself, which was kind of contrary to local custom. Normally, ladies in the community helped do it, but he did it himself. He put on her best clothing. He put on, this kind of becomes important, a high-necked, stiff-collared dress covered her neck, and a veil had been placed over her face. So basically, Dr. Knapp got there and tried to start examining to determine the cause of death, and Shu stayed right by his wife's side, cradling her head and sobbing. And because of the obvious grief he was in, Knapp felt that he gave kind of the body a cursory examination, said, yep, she's dead. But he did note some slight bruising along her neck. When he tried to look at it closer, Shu reacted so violently that the physician had to end the examination and he left. He originally listed her cause of death as everlasting faint and then as childbirth. I'm not sure what everlasting faint was.
Everlasting faint?
Yeah, it's a cause of death.
Was that like the vapors?
I think so, maybe so.
Everlasting, she fainted and she didn't get up.
Yeah, so don't really know whether or not she was pregnant or not, but 2 weeks prior, she had actually seen the doctor, and he had treated her for female trouble. So I don't know if that was the ICD code that he billed the insurance company as female trouble.
Female trouble.
Anyway, Dr. Knapp, after examining the body and determining that she was, in fact, dead, sent someone out to tell Zona's parents, but basically the word of her death had already spread throughout the community. I mean, it's a small town, so it kind of spread quickly. And so the story goes that basically when Zona's mother found out about her daughter's death, that she exclaimed, "The devil has killed her." That was her exclamation.
The devil being Shu.
Maybe, I don't know. So on Saturday, January 24th, her body was taken from her house to her parents' home. And that was basically where they wanted to have the viewing. And again, Shu was there the whole time, right by her side, making sure that, watching over her like a hawk, basically.
Because he was so distraught.
Yeah, he was so distraught. And the story goes that he showed extraordinary devotion toward the body, keeping vigil at the head of the open coffin during the move, and basically during the whole time. And it was all day Sunday, and neighbors arrived, and they brought food and things like that, as kind of was the custom in those days, and still is to this day in this area, at least. People always bring food over when somebody passes away and things like that. Everyone that came kind of noticed some bizarre behavior by Mr. Shu. His grief had changed back and forth between sadness, and then he had manic energy as well. And he allowed no one to get especially close to the coffin. Especially, he placed a pillow on one side of her head and rolled up a cloth on the other. And he said that basically he was trying to help her rest easier. And he had tied a large scarf around her neck and tearfully explained that it had been her favorite scarf and he wanted her to have it when she was buried. And when it came time to basically move the corpse to the cemetery, several people noticed that there seemed to be the same strange looseness on Zona's head. So if you notice, there's been a lot of discussion here about her head and her neck and things like that.
I'm picturing him cradling her head in the coffin and saying, "Don't touch her head. Nobody touch her head." She hated it when people touched her head.
Yeah.
So I'm the only one that could.
So people in the community had started to talk about kind of this bizarre thing and her untimely death and everything. And there was one person that was absolutely convinced that he had something to do that, and that was her mother. She thought that he was acting very suspicious before, and she had, you know, hated him pretty much from the very beginning, never really wanted her daughter to marry this guy.
They never listen. Daughters never listen.
She seemed to think that he had something to do with this, but there was actually no way to prove it. So one thing that she did, which is kind of an odd story, is that she took the sheet from inside the coffin, and she said she later tried to return it to Shu, but he refused it. She said she folded it back up and put it away, but it had a peculiar odor to it, so she tried to wash it out. She said that when she washed the sheet into a basin, the water inside turned red. Strangely, the sheet turned pink, and the color in the water vanished. She said she then boiled the sheet and hung it outside for several days, but the stain could not be removed, and she interpreted the eerie blood stains as a sign that she had been murdered.
Mm.
And that's when she says she began to start praying. And she said that every night for the next 4 weeks, she prayed fervently that her daughter would return to her and reveal the truth about how she had died. And then, basically, according to legend, her prayers were answered. And it says, over the course of 4 nights, the spirit of Zona Shu appeared at her mother's bedside. She would come as a bright light at first, and then the apparition would take form, chilling the air of the entire room. She would awaken her mother from her sleep and explain over and over again how her husband had murdered her. Shu had been abusive and cruel, she said, and had attacked her in a fit of rage because he thought she had not cooked any meat for his supper one night. He then had savagely broken her neck, and to show this, the ghost turned her head around completely around until she was facing backwards.
Oh, just like Linda Blair style from The Exorcist, huh?
Yeah. So the mother said, "You know what? I knew it. He had killed her. This ghost, the ghost of Zona, came and told me this. So I need to do something about it."
And they said, "Your daughter cooks meat in hell."
So her mom, Mary Jane, went to the local prosecutor, Mr. John Alfred Preston, and she wanted to convince him to reopen the story about, or reopen the investigation into her daughter's death. And she said, basically, "Hey, I've been visited by this ghost, and that's the evidence. That's all you need. I've been visited by this ghost."
Where was the father in all this? Did he not sleep in the room? Because he not verify this ghost for him, too?
I don't know. But she basically said that, "Hey, there's been a miscarriage of justice. You know, you need to fix this." Allegedly, the sheriff was very polite and sympathetic towards her, and they spoke for several hours regarding this story and what had been going on. And for whatever reason, at the end of the meeting, he agreed to dispatch deputies to speak to Dr. Knapp and some other people involved in the case. Like, "Well, you know, I'll send out a couple of my best guys to look at this and see what's going on."
I don't think Dr. Knapp was completely sober when he did that evaluation.
So basically, part of the theory is that given Shu's strange behavior during this whole time, there was a lot of talk in the community. So, you know, whether or not it was just the ghost story that got him to want to reopen it, or whether it was some kind of the talk in the community or not, I mean, that's kind of up for debate. But no doubt the ghost story is what had the mom come to the sheriff. So the sheriff eventually went out to see Dr. Knapp, and he basically told the sheriff that, "Well, you know, I did examine the body, but it was somewhat incomplete. And probably if we did an autopsy, that might clear things up a little bit." The only problem was they had already buried her.
Mm-hmm.
So some days later, they ordered the body exhumed, and they wanted to have an inquest jury, which we've talked about before. And basically, an inquest jury is where a coroner presents evidence to a jury, and the jury makes a decision about the cause of death.
All right.
So this is odd, too. The autopsy was performed in the Nickel Schoolhouse, which was just a short distance away from the graveyard where she was buried. and they dismissed the school children early on February 22nd, 1897, so they could examine the body in the schoolhouse.
You don't hear about that happening too often.
Could you imagine that if you go to school and say, well, we're going to send you home early. We're going to have to bring in a dead body to look at. Elementary school kids.
The kids wouldn't care. They'd run out. Hey, they got another dead one bringing in. We're out of school today.
Yeah. So supposedly, Shu did not like the idea of this whole autopsy being performed and complained about it. But
well, of course he didn't.
He didn't have much of a choice, and the sheriff had actually ordered him to be present when they were doing it. He's basically said that, well, if I don't go to it voluntarily, they're going to arrest me and bring me there anyway, so I might as well go. He basically was supposedly had said when he was arrested that they will not be able to prove I did it. Allegedly, he said that. So that might be one of those things where you're like, whoops, did I really say that?
Freudian slip.
Yeah. So the autopsy lasted for about 3 hours. The doctors were working under kerosene lanterns at the time. And the body of the woman, Zona, was in a near state of perfect preservation thanks to the cold temperatures of February. Because it was cold that year, so her body was fairly well preserved.
So she was like a popsicle.
Pretty much. There was a jury of 5 men, and they watched proceedings, and they huddled together in the pretty cold building with the different officers of the court. Mr. Shu, Andy Jones, the boy who had found the body, he was there for whatever reason.
Good old Andy.
Good old sidekick Andy. And some other witnesses and spectators decided to come in, too.
Why not? What else are you doing this evening? Let's grab a cold one and go down and watch the autopsy at the local elementary school.
the doctors cut an incision along the back of the skull so they could remove the brain. They quickly found out what they were looking for, though, when they did that. We have found your wife's neck to have been broken, one of the physicians spoke to Trout Shu. His head dropped and an expression of despair crossed over his face. They cannot prove I did it, he whispered.
Which to who?
I don't know.
His lawyer? Did he have a lawyer there?
I mean, I assume all this came out at trial.
You'll never take me alive, you coppers. We already got you. Oh.
So basically, they said that discovering a broken neck like that is actually one of the more difficult injuries to detect. It can be even harder because when the human head is naturally, since it's naturally kind of heavy, when somebody passes away, it kind of is very loose because there's no muscles supporting it. But the autopsy report was quite critical to Shu. It basically said that the discovery was made that the neck was broken and the windpipe smashed. On the throat were marks of fingers indicating that she had been choked. The neck was dislocated between the first and second vertebrae. The ligaments were torn and ruptured. The windpipe had been crushed at a point in the front of the neck. So basically, it was pretty clear that she had been choked and her neck was broken.
Yeah. That was a violent death.
Yeah. And so the findings were made public, and everybody in the community was going crazy about this because it became clear that this guy, Shu, had most likely, who's an outsider, had most likely murdered Zona.
Mm-hmm.
So he was locked up in the jail on Washington Street in Lewisburg. And despite the fact that there was a lot of evidence against him, and it pretty much was, I guess it was kind of circumstantial. There was no eyewitness or anything like that. But he pled not guilty to it. And while he was awaiting trial, people started digging into Shu's past. And they found out, basically, that he had been married before. And that Zona had actually been his third wife. And his first marriage ended a divorce while he was in prison. And that during the divorce decree, she had alleged that he had beaten her during that time. He had married again to a Lucy Ann Tritt, and she died 8 months after.
Of mysterious circumstances.
After they were married, of mysterious circumstance.
Yeah.
He had claimed that she had fallen and hit her head on a rock, but nobody really believed her.
Right.
And soon after that is when he packed up and moved to Greenbrier County.
It's just like that other episode we did, the husband always did it.
Yeah.
It always goes back to him.
One of the odd things, and this is kind of just an aside about him, while he was in jail during this, he was reportedly in good spirits and that his grieving for Zona had ended. He actually had announced that he had a lifelong goal of having 7 wives, and since Zona had only been his third, he was still young and he was going to have more. So
that was he was going to kill 3 more and stay with the last one.
And he actually told reporters that his guilt in the matter could not be proved. So he didn't actually say, I'm innocent. He said, you can't prove me guilty. Which those are two kind of different things, you might say there.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a trial, and it began on June 22nd, 1897. And lots of different people testified against Shu. And the interesting thing is that the appearance of Mary Jane Hester, Zona's mother. They put her on the stand, the prosecutor put her on the stand, both as the mother of the dead woman and also as the first person to notice the unusual circumstances of her death. He wanted to make sure that she appeared both sane and reliable, so he really didn't talk about the issue of the ghost story, because he was afraid it would make her seem kind of irrational and seem kind of weird, and he thought it might be inadmissible.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted the teller of the story, in this case, was Zona Shu, and he obviously couldn't cross-examine the ghost, because the ghost wouldn't appear at trial, even if you subpoena the ghost.
Well, then lock it up. Lock that ghost up.
That's true. And also, it'd be a hearsay objection, I imagine, too. Objection, Your Honor, hearsay. He can subpoena the ghost and bring her here to ask her those questions. So,
conjure it up.
Yeah, we need to
get the Ouija board out.
We don't need a subpoena, we need a conjuring.
Yeah, a Ouija board.
But the unfortunate thing for Shu, his attorney decided to make a strategic play and started asking Miss Hester about the ghostly sighting, mm-hmm. probably wanting to kind of make her seem kind of crazy.
Yeah, get that part out and say, look, she's crazy. Look, she has these dreams and everything. Yeah,
which, you know, it might kind of discredit her, because she was the one who probably was the most damning to him, because, you know, you put a mother on the stand talking about mm-hmm. her dead daughter. I mean, you know, that's pretty inflammatory mm-hmm. to a jury.
But it backfired.
It did. He said that basically her visions were crazy ravings and worked hard to try to admit that she might have been mistaken about what she allegedly saw. He continued to badger her for quite some time, but the mother never wavered from what she had seen. Then the defense counsel realized the testimony was not going the way he wanted. He dismissed her. But it seems by that time the damage was already done mm-hmm. because...
she came across as sincere, and the jury yeah. believed her that really had happened.
But here's the interesting thing. Because the defense and not the prosecution had introduced the testimony about the ghost, the judge really couldn't tell the jury to exclude it. It was apparent that most people in the community believed that Mary Jane had seen her daughter's ghost. Despite Shu's eloquent testimony in his own defense, the jury quickly found him guilty. Actually, 10 of the jurors actually even voted that he should be hanged, which basically can tell you about how much they believed her story.
Mm-hmm.
Since there was not a unanimous verdict for death, though, he was just sentenced to life in prison. Here's kind of an interesting thing after he was sentenced to prison. So basically the ghost testimony kind of did him in. But everybody in Greenbrier County was pretty upset about this. They wanted this guy sentenced to death. Mm-hmm. So there was a lynch mob formed on July 11th, 1897. Supposedly 15 to 30 men assembled 8 miles west of Lewisburg, and they purchased a new rope, and they were well armed with Winchesters and revolvers, and they started marching towards the jail. But allegedly a man named George Hara contacted the sheriff and said, hey, you got to get him out of here. There's a lynch mob coming. So they basically spirited him out of the jail and kind of hid him away in the countryside till they could get the mob to disband. And actually, some of the leaders of that mob were later prosecuted for forming a lynch mob.
Wait, you know, 8 miles is a long distance back in them days.
Oh, yeah.
They should have formed their mob closer to the jail so word couldn't get there first.
Yep.
So if you're ever going to form a mob, pay attention to your modes of transportation.
Form it up close.
Yeah, form a close mob.
But Shu, he didn't last very long. He was moved to the West Virginia State Pen in Moundsville, which actually didn't close until not that long ago.
Yeah, not that long ago.
And he lived there for 3 years, and he died on March 13th, 1900, from one of the epidemics of measles, mumps, or pneumonia that swept through the prison that spring.
Well, good.
Yeah.
That place is probably open for ghost tours.
Oh, I'm sure it is. That one, and there's one in Weston, too.
Yeah, we went by the one in Weston.
Yeah. So,
that was an old insane asylum.
Yeah, yeah. They've had that on Ghost Hunters and things like that, too, I think.
Yeah.
But he was buried in basically the unclaimed graveyard there, and there's actually no gravestone or anything like that.
Pauper's grave.
Yeah, so we don't know anything about him. Mary Jane Robinson Hester, the mother, she told her tale to anybody who would listen. And she died on September 1916 with never recanting her story and always telling the truth. And Zona was actually, as a ghost, was never seen again. But there are different markers and things like that around the community. And her legacy still is there in Greenbrier County because there's a really tasty beer named after her.
Yeah, well, they have those historical markers around at different places in the state for different things, battles in the Civil War and different things like that. And there's one marking that.
Yeah.
There's one that tells that story of the Greenbrier ghost.
There is, yeah.
But, you know, the one thing that they would have to say, you know, where did this come from, is she described how she was killed.
She did.
With the broken neck. Yeah. And how would she have known that? She didn't examine the body. She didn't have medical training or any way to do that. And that was how she died. Now, if she had said, well, they broke her neck and then they found that she'd been stabbed or something, Well, now we've got a different story, but she described exactly how she was killed.
Yeah, I mean, the creepy thing is, think about that. Like, if this ghost appears to you and says, what happened, and my neck was broken, and then the neck, the head spins all the way around.
Yeah.
That's kind of, it's kind of creepy.
Yeah, well, try the neck test, and they take the body and turn the head away. Yep, yeah. That's it.
Well, and you know,
matches a ghost.
And you know, this might be one of those things that at the time, you don't think anything of him, like putting a scarf around there, dressing her in this high neck thing, putting a pillow there so her head's not flopping around. But then after the autopsy shows this, you have the testimony from a ghost,
mm-hmm.
and then you start thinking about how he was acting.
Yeah.
Well, maybe, you know, maybe it's confirmation bias. Maybe it's not. I don't know, but maybe that, you know.
Maybe that's why they named that beer after her. Because it makes your head spin.
I don't know.
It's got a high alcohol content. Yeah. Maybe.
We'll have to post a, if you go to the Greenbrier Valley Brewing and you look at their beer list, you can see the logo for it.
Mm-hmm.
They have really cool logos for their beer too, by the way. And their logo for Zonin's Revenge is a pretty cool, like, ghost mm-hmm. pointing her finger. So
yeah, they've got some quality brews there.
They do. They do.
They come down for the beer fest that they have there, you mm-hmm. know, down at Heritage Station every year.
Yep.
They come down for that and they always have good offerings.
And unfortunately, we are not sponsored by them. I wish we were.
Yeah.
So if you're listening, Greenbrier Valley Brewing, sponsor us.
Yeah. Send us a few samples and we'll talk about how good each one is.
Well, we already did that.
Oh, yeah, we did. We didn't drink. I mean, we didn't get any for free.
I know.
It's better. Free beer always tastes better than beer you pay for.
I agree.
That's my favorite kind of beer. All right. Well, while that was the only one where vision of a ghost happened to solve a mystery, a murder, an actual crime in the United States, I came up with a couple that happened in other places besides here.
Really? That happen like this outside of West Virginia?
Yes. They have hauntings in other places, too. Of course, I mean, when you talk about rural Australia and rural West Virginia in the 1800s, it might not have been too much different other than the damn kangaroos jumping around once they take your head off. There's a lot of things over in Australia that'll kill you. Over here, it's just other hillbillies.
For the most part, yeah.
The mysterious death of Fred Fisher, whose ghost solved his own murder.
Oh,
sounds familiar, huh?
It does.
It's an Australian Halloween mystery. The mysterious tale of the death of a farmer and how his own specter led police to arrest his murderer. Now, this was in 2016 when this was written, so that was 192 years ago.
Oh,
and
wow.
It was right around Halloween. So they have this big festival that honors this. So
where is the festival?
It's in Australia in Campbelltown.
Campbelltown?
Campbelltown.
Oh, Campbelltown.
Okay. Yeah. Campbelltown. And it's a weird spelling because there's two L's there right next to a T, so it looks funny when you see that word all together, Campbelltown.
Hmm.
But it was 192 years ago this month that the bloodied body of Frederick Fisher was found in a lonely grave in Campbelltown, now a bustling suburb in Sydney's southwest. Legend has it, after police became flummoxed, they were flummoxed.
That's a good word.
Fisher's disappearance. It was the spectral remains of Fisher himself which led a man to being executed for his gruesome and violent death. Today, the legend lives on with Campbelltown's Festival of Fisher's Ghost, and it kicks off on November 4th this year. Two years ago it did. I don't know when it kicks off this year, but it's an annual event. So it is going to kick off soon. So if you're listening in Australia and you're interested, you can go there still. You get that, Leon Keith? You can still head there. All right. Campbelltown would have been totally rural in the mid-1820s with maybe only 10 or 12 buildings. It was a pretty raw and rugged place. In this ruggedness, probably about 1822, came Fisher, a man of fair complexion and brown hair who was raised in London in the suburb of Greenwich. A stash of forged banknotes saw him sentenced to 14 years incarceration in Australia. See, that's where they were sending their prisoners.
Yeah.
And that's how Australia got established. See, they're all prisoners or descendants of prisoners.
That's not true.
But his clear intellect saw him employed by the colonial rulers with less than half his sentence served. All right, so anyway, he came into possession of a bunch of land, and he became pretty well off. But then he had a fight with a business partner, and he pulled a knife on him. So, fearful that he would be behind bars for years, he assigned power of attorney over his land to a friend of his named Worrell, W-O-R-R-E-L. Mm-hmm. World bragged it's unlikely Fisher would ever leave jail and reportedly said of the land, "It's all mine now." But the judge said that Fisher had been provoked, and within 6 months, he was back and reclaimed his land.
He's like, "Hey, thanks for watching my land for me,
buddy. Yeah, I'm ready to take it back now.
Give it back now."
Yeah. And so, you know, Worrell was pissed. He thought he had acquired all that.
Yeah.
So on the night of June 17th, 1826 was deep winter. So I guess June is winter in Australia.
What, the other side of the world there.
So they get like the opposite of us, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. As the evening drew in, Fisher would have felt the chill in the air magnified by the area's distance from the coast and its proximity to the mountains. Fred Fisher, George Worrell, and a couple of other gentlemen had a very good drinking session at an inn in Campbelltown that night. And when it was done, they went their separate ways, with Worrell and Fisher heading home. They shared like an apartment together. Mm-hmm. That was the last time Fred Fisher was seen alive. The locals were baffled as to where he had gone, but there was no mystery for Worrell. He told everyone Fisher had left Australia and headed back to England. Just like that, in the dead of the night, without saying a word to anybody, right?
Seems reasonable.
Once again, Fisher had given Worrell custodianship of his property, Worrell said, and within 3 weeks, his horse and all his personal belongings had been sold. People became suspicious and suspected Worrell of foul play. Eventually, George Worrell was arrested, but it was done before a body could be found. Put simply, there was no smoking gun to prosecute Worrell.
Yep.
Months passed, and the mystery of where Fisher was deepened. Then, on a spring October evening, a farmer called John Farley stumbled across something extraordinary that he would never forget and swear was true until his dying day. Now, as usual, Farley was out drinking when he was coming home. So this adds to the story.
A lot of drinking going on.
Yeah, there's a lot of drinking. They're in Australia. Yeah. What else is there to do other than dodge kangaroos? Farley had been out drinking, and when he was coming home, he spotted what he thought was Fred Fisher sitting on the railing of a bridge. He had appeared on a corner of the land that was owned by Fisher. Farley tried to speak to Fisher to ask him where he'd been all these months, but Fred Fisher didn't say anything, and as Farley approached, he realized it wasn't Fred at all, but a ghostly figure. Ooh. The ghost then raised his left arm and pointed down the creek some distance away. In fright, Farley panicked, and the next day was found incoherent and only slowly began to reveal what he saw. With no better leads to go on, the local police constable enlisted the help of a local Aboriginal tracker named Namet and searched the creek. Good old Namet was called in on the job.
That's right.
They looked around the creek and discovered some blood, and then further down the waterway, they found a body buried in a shallow grave. Mm. The body was partially decomposed with a saddened, death-like, sickly white. The face was decomposed and unrecognizable, but the clothes were clearly Fisher's. At the trial, it took the jury just 15 minutes to find Worrell guilty of Fisher's death. He was executed in February 1827 and on the gallows, admitted he had killed him, but he said it was a mistake. He said he thought he was a horse in the wheat crop.
Huh.
Yeah, right. In the middle of a cold night, and you thought he was a horse in the wheat crop, so you killed him.
It's not a very good excuse.
No, they weren't too creative. I think he had been drinking then, too.
Yeah, for no doubt.
So anyway, the tale of Fisher's ghost became the stuff of legend. It spread completely around the world. A silent film of Fisher's ghost was made in 1924, and versions of the story appeared in compendiums of Victorian ghost stories compiled by famous writer Arthur Conan Doyle. That the ghost appeared so close to Halloween was pure coincidence, said Mr. White. The annual event wasn't even marked at that time in Australia. But perhaps it is the most famous legacy in Campbelltown's Festival of Fisher's Ghost, which began in the 1950s. Huh. So,
might have to try to find that Arthur Conan Doyle short story.
Yeah, so that's another one where supposedly he appeared and he pointed to where his body was so they could find it and convict his killer.
But no testimony from the ghost or about the ghost, I guess.
No, I guess just the fact they found the body, then the body was used as evidence. Yeah. The ghostly evidence was not entered into.
So West Virginia is still all alone with our ghostly evidence.
That's right. Now, from another part of the world, we have the Hammersmith ghost murder case of 1804 in the UK.
The Hammersmith
ghost murder case. And I've read this one before. I don't know what episode. It was in preparation for an episode.
Really?
I don't know which one, but I'd read this before, and I didn't I don't know what it was, but I don't think we talked about it before. Near the end of 1803, a number of people claimed to have seen and even been attacked by a ghost in the Hammersmith area of London. A ghost believed by locals to be the spirit of a suicide victim. On the 3rd of January, 1804, a member of one of the armed patrols set up in the wake of the reports shot and killed a bricklayer, Thomas Millwood, mistaking the white clothes of Millwood's trade for a ghostly apparition. The culprit, a 29-year-old excise officer named Francis Smith, was found guilty of murder and sentenced to death, but it was commuted to 1 year's hard labor. Sentenced to go from death to 1 year hard labor.
I remember this story because we were talking about, I think, maybe excusable neglect or something along those lines, because basically the guy's work gave him made him look white with the appearance of maybe being a ghost, and with all the fervor of the ghost around, that's why he shot him.
And he mistook him, right.
Yeah.
So a number of people had claimed different things, seeing him and being attacked by him and all this kind of stuff, and it began to circulate. Two women, one elderly and the other pregnant, were reported to have been seized by the ghost on separate occasions while walking in the churchyard. And they were apparently so frightened they both died from shock a few days afterwards. A brewer's servant, Thomas Groom, later testified that while walking through a churchyard with a companion one night at close to 9 p.m., something rose from behind a tombstone and seized him by the throat. Hearing the scuffle, his companion turned around, at which the ghost gave me a twist around, and I saw nothing. I gave a bit of a push out with my fist and felt something soft like a great coat.
A bit of a twist around.
On the 29th of December, William Girdler, a night watchman, saw the ghost while near Beaver Lane and gave chase. The apparition threw off its shroud and managed to escape. But anyway, so at the corner of Beaver Lane, while making his rounds at 10:30 on the 3rd of January, 1804, Girdler met one of the armed citizens patrolling the area, 29-year-old excise officer Francis Smith. He was armed with a shotgun. Smith told Girdler he was going to look for that supposed ghost. Girdler agreed that he would join Smith after he had called the hour at 11 p.m., and that they would take the ghost if possible. Then they went their separate ways. Just past 11 p.m., Smith encountered Thomas Millwood, a bricklayer, who was wearing the normal white clothing of his trade, linen trousers, entirely white, washed very clean, a waistcoat of flannel, apparently new, very white, and an apron which he wore around him. Millwood had been heading home from a visit to his parents and sister, who lived in Black Lion Lane. According to Anne Millwood, the plasterer's sister, immediately after seeing her brother off, she heard Smith challenge him, saying, "Damn you! Who are you? And what are you? Damn you, I'll shoot you!" After which Smith shot him in the left of the lower jaw and killed him.
Ugh.
So after hearing the shot, they came out and, you know, everybody was agitated and all the, they, you know, they go through the autopsy, which they discovered he was shot and the shot killed him.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for the autopsy for that, Captain Obvious.
He died of an everlasting faint.
Yeah.
And being shot in the face.
Now, Smith was tried for willful murder. The deceased wife, Mrs. Fulbrook, stated that she had warned the deceased to cover his white clothing with a great coat, as he had already been mistaken for the ghost on previous occasions. On Saturday evening, he and I were at home, for he lived with me. He said he had frightened two ladies and a gentleman who were coming along the terrace in a carriage. For that, the man said he dared to say, "Where goes the ghost?" And that he said he was no more a ghost than he was, and asked him, using a bad word, did he want a punch of the head. I begged of him to change his dress. Thomas says, as there is a piece of work about the ghost, and your clothes look white, pray do put on your great coat, that you may not run in any danger. So he knew, he kind of knew, I think he was maybe playing up on this a little bit, so he kind of set himself up.
But yeah.
Anyway, they said that they found in there that, you know, he said, "Look, we were looking for this ghost. This guy showed up, so I shot him." And the Lord Chief Baron observed that Smith had neither acted in self-defense nor had shot Millwood by accident. He had not been provoked by the supposed apparition or had attempted to apprehend it. Millwood had not committed any offense to justify being shot, and even if the supposed ghost had been shot, it would not have been acceptable, as frightening people while pretending to be a ghost was not a serious felony, but a far less serious misdemeanor, only meriting a small fine, not buckshot to the throat.
Yeah.
You know, so The judge closed his remarks by reminding the jury that the accused's good character meant nothing in this case. Therefore, McDonald directed the jury to find the accused guilty of murder if they believed the facts presented by the witnesses. After considering for an hour, the jury returned a verdict of manslaughter. McDonald informed the jury that the court could not receive such a verdict and that they must find Smith guilty of murder or acquit him. That Smith believed Millwood to be a ghost was irrelevant. The jury then returned with a verdict of guilty. After passing the customary sentence of death, McDonald stated his intent to report the case to the king, who had the power to commute the sentence. So he insisted they charge him a murder, but then he went to the king, got him to commute it to 1 year hard labor. But this established a precedence in the UK as far as if you act on a mistaken belief, it is not a sufficient defense to a criminal charge. And, you know, if you had known better, if there was other ways to test it out, like I said, he didn't try to apprehend him.
Yeah.
He didn't try to do anything. He just shot the guy. So that's what they're saying. He couldn't do it. It wasn't until 1984 that a case came along of self-defense that was able to clarify that law further. Let's see. It says Gladstone Williams had seen a man dragging a younger man violently along the street whilst the younger man shouted for help. Mistakenly believing that an assault was taking place, he intervened and subsequently injured the purported assailant, who was actually attempting to apprehend a suspected thief. So what he saw was a big guy dragging a little guy down the street and the little guy yelling for help. So he intervened and shot or somehow injured the big guy.
Yeah.
And the big guy was apprehending the little guy because he was a thief.
Yeah.
Now, they said in this case, you are able to act if not, it doesn't just have to be a self-defense, but where self-defense or the prevention of a crime is concerned. So if the jury came to the conclusion that the defendant believed or may have believed that he was being attacked or that a crime was being committed and that force was necessary to protect himself or to prevent the crime, then the prosecution have not proved their case. So that's what they said.
Yeah.
He had every reason to believe that he was saving this kid's life or whatever, that this other one was doing something to him. So that was where they established that. And so the guy was found innocent in that case. And the appeal was quashed. And the decision was approved by the Privy Council in Beckford v. the Queen in 1988 and was later written into law in the Criminal Justice Immigration Act of 2008.
That reminds me of remember the movie The Naked Gun?
Yeah.
There was a scene where Frank Drebin, you know, he's the cop, and he's talking to the mayor. And the mayor says, "Drebin, I don't want any more trouble like you had last year on the South Side. Understand? That's my policy." And he says, "Yes, well, when I see five weirdos dressed in toga stabbing a guy in the middle of the park in full view of 100 people, I shoot the bastards. That's my policy." And the mayor says, "That was a Shakespeare in the Park production of Julius Caesar, you moron. You killed five actors." it's just kind of like that, you know?
And he said, "Et tu, Brute?"
Pretty much.
Well, the last thing I've got, even though these were not, like you say, ones that...
Ghostly testimony?
Yeah, ghostly testimony. These were five other cases where ghosts were sent back to, like, solve their own cases or crimes that happened supposedly... The first one happened with a pilot in 1913, and his plane crashed during routine training exercise. And he was a Lieutenant Arthur, and he kept his ghostly figure kept making appearances at the hangar and at the airport where they were. And there were phantom plane noises, and all these people, there was gear that would be missing, mm-hmm. and different things happened to the plane, and they all were saying, you know, it had to do with him. Well, what had happened, he kept appearing to these people, and they, another man who had known Arthur said Arthur appeared in his room and tried to speak to him, but couldn't make any sound. The story became so infamous that supposedly a German pilot who was shot down and captured behind Allied lines asked what the latest news on the ghost was. So this became talk of it. Because of these sightings, a superstitious pilot started thinking there was something keeping Arthur from moving on. Eventually, a new investigation into his death commenced, which absolved Arthur of any blame. It turns out that planes in 1913 were kind of prone to falling apart sometimes. So after his name was cleared, his ghost supposedly made his final appearances in front of three old comrades, smiling at each one of them before vanishing forever.
Oh, so his ghost was worried that it was his own fault that he had crashed or something?
Yeah, that his reputation had been ruined as a pilot, that they said that he had crashed from his own pilot error.
Yeah.
And he had to clear his name. So that when they finally acknowledged that, he disappeared and was never seen again. He just appeared to three old Air Force buddies and, you know, told him he'd let him know if there was golf in the afterlife.
Just faded away.
That's right. Here's another one where a psychic led her to a completely unrelated murder. Now, inviting a psychic to help in a murder investigation is practically announcing to the killer that they should feel pretty free to, you know, buy a house, settle down, sit back, that they don't have to worry. But sometimes even psychics can get lucky and find a needle in a haystack. In 2010, Australian psychic Cheryl Carol Loggerway claimed she had a dream which showed her where to find the body of Keisha Abrams, a missing six-year-old girl. And while we would personally give a wide berth to any murder locations we dream of, Carol Loggerway decided to check the place out. She didn't find Abrahams, but she did find the macabre consolation prize of an adult woman's decomposing torso. I can't talk. So she didn't find the one she was looking for, but she did find a dead body. Now, first of all, are you not incriminating yourself when you do something like that?
I would think so.
You lead authorities to a dead body? Yeah, it's right here. Oh, it's not the one I thought it was. It's a different one. How do you know where these dead bodies are? But anyway, the mangled torso was eventually identified as remains of Christy McDougal, who had been strangled to death and chopped into pieces by her boyfriend. It wasn't totally random. The bottom was found on a remote Aboriginal reserve, which had already been searched thoroughly because police believed it was a possible dumping spot for Abraham's body. Mm. She was later found elsewhere, and her mother was convicted of her murder. So the little girl was later found, and the mother was convicted in that one. But while Carol Loggerway's discovery led to the arrest and conviction of McDougal's killer, local police made it very clear that this discovery does not change their opinion about the use of psychics. So they said, as the old saying goes, you've heard a version of mine of this, even a blind squirrel finds a dismembered torso once in a while.
Is that the way the saying goes?
Well, I've used the one, even a blind hog finds an acre now and then.
That's true.
So evidently this is the different version of it. Third is the infamous Red Barn murder.
Yeah.
You heard of that one, haven't you?
I have.
It was 1827. Maria Martin and William Corder had arranged to elope, as dramatic young beaux with sketchy reputations are wont to do. They met at the Red Barn as their place to take off, and then supposedly they both left.
Right.
But when her family would try to contact her by sending letters and such.
Facebook.
Yeah, Facebook, you know, in 1827. She was never available, and they could never talk to her. When they'd go to find her, she would be out of town visiting someone else. So they became suspicious that she had not really run off out of town along with William, that William was the only one that left. So the mother was sure that something had happened, and she kept saying they were going to meet in the Red Barn. I think it's at the Red Barn. And the husband wouldn't have anything to say. Just forget about it, Betsy. It's just, you're just getting carried away there, honey. Just go to bed. Cook dinner and go to bed. And so... anyway, so then she changed her tactic and she said, I dream. She came to me in a dream and she's buried in the Red Barn.
Yeah.
Now you go over there and dig her up right now.
Here's a shovel.
Yeah, go dig her up. She's there. My baby came to me in a dream. You go. Okay, woman, you're crazy. I'll go just to prove it. And sure enough, she was there.
Yep.
Which I don't know that was so much spectrally, you know, invoked as it was just common sense.
Straight common sense. Yeah. Here's the last place they were seen together.
Why don't we look there?
Let's search that place. Let's search that recent mound of disturbed dirt over there. That looks like a good place to start.
So when they dug and found the body, they went and got William and brought him back, and he served justice. Now, here was one where it was a case of possession. It says the law of headlines dictates that anytime a headline has a question... or any time that a headline is a question mark after it, the correct answer is nope. Like, do cookies cause cancer? Are Brad and Jennifer getting back together? Or can you look at this video of a puppy and a kitten who are friends without crying? But when it says, did voice from grave finger murder suspect, then you may want to take notice.
Yeah. It's like,
This one goes back to 1977 murder of Terista Bassa, a hospital employee who was found stripped, stabbed, and burned in a ransacked apartment. After weeks of investigating, the police still weren't any closer to finding the killer, with only a journey entry stating, "Get tickets for AS." Now, after six frustrating months, detectives received a tip about another employee at Bassa's hospital named Alan Showery. AS. Remember the note? A man with very suspicious initials. But he...
Yes, AS is a very suspicious initials.
But who came through with the tip? Teresa Bassa, if you can believe it. When police traced the call, they ended up meeting Jose and Remy Chua. According to Remy Bassa, Showery showed up at Bassa's apartment to fix her TV, but ended up murdering her and stealing her jewelry. When asked how they knew so much about the murder, Jose claimed that on three occasions, his wife had been possessed by Bassa, and then explained the details of the crime.
Wow.
You know, that classic scenario every marriage goes through sooner or later. Police searched Showery's apartment and found a ring and pendant belonging to Bassa. They arrested Showery, who eventually pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 14 years. So
that's not very long.
No, it wasn't very long. You would think it would have been longer than that.
Yeah.
But so the question, though, would remain is, how did this person know this? I mean, I think that there's more to the story. These people also worked at the hospital.
Yeah.
With those two. So I think there was something more. They were involved in it somehow because they knew the details of what was going on, and they're going to explain it through the dead person came and possessed me. So that's their story of how they did that.
They're such close friends that the spirit came to them.
Yeah, I guess so. But now here's the thing. They had to have used that information to get a search warrant.
Yeah.
So it was a testimony, but they used that this person's possession. I mean, they said he did it and he robbed her. So they got a search warrant to search to find actual something to connect him to the crime.
Well, maybe they just said in their affidavit for the search warrant, they probably just said, we have obtained information from so-and-so that he did this.
They didn't say that it came from the dead girl through the living girl.
The guy's like, how'd you find that information out? Oh, a ghost told you? Oh, we're going to leave that part out.
Yeah. We're going to fix this up.
We're just going to say that you have information.
And while a lot of these things have happened a long time ago, it's not that like they all happened a long time ago. In 2013, Adrian Dow confessed to the murder of Jennifer Stewart, claiming that after he committed the crime, he went for a walk and saw the ghost of his victim. Since that day, Dow claims he started believing in God and belatedly concluded that it's not a good thing to kill someone.
Huh.
So he figured that out.
In other news, he's a rocket scientist.
Killing people, not good. Okay. It's not the most inspiring religious conversion on record, you know, but Dow also committed the murder because he thought it would help his rap career. So maybe he's not the best person to take life advice. In April 2017, serial killer Terry Childs confessed to two murders while serving time for three more.
Huh.
Childs says he was being eaten up by his victims, Joan Mack and Christopher Hall. And no, he didn't mean in the abstract sense of overwhelming guilt. He told police they were in his cell, staring at him and eating up his brain. The two new crimes he confessed to occurred in 1984 and 1985, which makes these some pretty damn persistent ghosts.
I think the guy might just be crazy.
You think so?
Yeah. That's not persuasive.
If you had two people eating your brain, you'd be crazy too.
Probably so.
Then finally, in January 2017, apparently a banner year for ghost-induced confessions, Jose Ferrara confessed to a 1982 crime wherein he pushed 13-year-old Carrie Ann Jopek down a stairway to her death because she refused to have sex with him, which hits about every number on the male monster bingo card outside of the school shooting category. Her mother credits Jopek rather than the police for solving the crime because 33 years after she was killed, Ferrara claimed that the girl's spirit had been haunting him and made him confess. So keep that in mind if you ever plan to haunt someone. Persistence can get you results in ways that a couple of quick jump scares never can.
Jump scare.
Justin's good at the jump scare, too.
He is good at the jump scare.
But that was some other ones that they ended up confessing because the ghosts of who they confessed came back to haunt them.
But
So as it stands right now, West Virginia still stands as the only ghost testimony.
That's right. Only ghost testimony. There's ghosts that have been involved in solving some of them, but not to the point of testimony.
I like it.
There you go.
We got something going for us here.
That's right.
Number one in the country in ghost testimony.
So come drink some good beer and follow some good ghost stories.
That's right.
Although you can't see her because she was put to rest after.
She was, but there's a rendition of her on the label, so maybe buy one of those beers and look at them.
Yeah. There you go.
Well, that normally would bring us to...
Legal Breeze.
But since this was a kind of a ghost story type of court-appointed, we really don't have any legal briefs.
We don't have any?
I don't. Let me ask you a question.
All right.
What is an inquest jury?
It's a jury that wants to determine a cause of death.
Yeah. There we go.
They listen to evidence that determines a cause of death.
How about this? Right. What is a lily dipper?
A lily dipper is someone who only puts the tip in
and doesn't stick
the whole thing in. You don't ever want to be one of them.
Don't be a lily dipper.
I don't know. They might.
Especially if you're on a boat.
When I got one for you.
Uh-oh, here we go.
When Australian police can't solve a crime, what do they become?
Kanga clueless?
What? Flummoxed.
Flummoxed.
Apparently, they're flummoxed. That's what happens in Australia. When you're surrounded with crime and kangaroos, you become flummoxed.
I'm going to stick with Kanga clueless.
Kanga clueless. Well, that's kangarooless if they escape, like that's in right. South Carolina.
Well, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode, and I hope you guys have a wonderful Halloween.
I hope you're not too scared from our ghost stories, or maybe we hope you are.
Jump scare.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well, then not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out, though, right?
Usually. Good. This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurf. And I'm just a dude.
Thanks for listening.